having established that you're present, we'll start to do a different meditation. So taking a moment to arrive, to be here and not in the future, to not be in the past, as best one is able. And then arriving in the body and taking the body as our object. We know the body is made up of just of a handful of materiality, and mostly it's empty atoms. So there's so much space in the body. What's there is mostly liquid anyway. So, and then moving to the edges of the body, the edges around the arms, around the back, or the chest, or the face, or the ear sides of the skull. We can feel our awareness or our heat or our energy as it penetrates out beyond the physical body. In the front, the back, the sides. So our boundaries, which are quite clear in some ways, but on the energetic level, a little less clear. So you can get a burn from something that's near you, that's not actually touching the skin, but its energy penetrates your energetic space, and you get burned, or cool, or refreshed. So this lack of hardness of separation, more an open, the space that is defined by body, like the space defined by this room, is still part of space. Inner space, outer space, outward space, if that's a better. So taking space as our object. How vast space is. Ironically, sometimes the people who can most easily access that have trouble because they go to space-y-ness. It's not a lack of being able to access spaciousness. It's that there's not a measured approach to it, and one gets washed away. So just feeling the spaciousness within the body and just around the body to begin with, and then expanding a little further out to the space that's kind of, I don't know, 3 feet, 6 feet in front of you, 3 feet front and back and to the right. And we have an intimacy with space some far away from our body. And then we have all these feelings about space and how we're sharing it with another. But just for now, interested in the sense of space, all the spaciousness that comes from being aware of the vast space in this room, these wonderful high ceilings, all the space to the front, all the space back to the doors and windows, over towards the bathroom and over towards embodied consciousness sitting in all this space. The embodied porous, available, interacting with all that's in the space. So vast, this inner experience, this knowing of space. In the mind's eye, we can know the space that surrounds the center here, the parking lot, the upstairs building, the train tracks on the bus backside. So much space everywhere. On out into this neighborhood of Seattle. You may know it and can picture it with detail, or simply know that it exists. But there is a space that we call Seattle, and this is a neighborhood of space within that space. And the knowing has no trouble. So what characterizes this spaciousness, this space? It itself, it has an emptiness characteristic. Were space not inherently empty, there would not be room for all the objects. There's an energetic quality to space. This gets up to questions about dark matter and dark energy that we don't want to go to because those are conceptual experiences. The emptiness of space, its vastness, its stillness, is available here and now. The inner space, vastness, the outer space. When you feel the inner spaciousness, does it change in any way the experience of the body, or how you're holding the body, or how the body is manifesting? Just dwell there for a moment. In the inner space, this empty inner space, this empty space that is so still, all sorts of things are going on in that space. Liquids flowing, rhythmic beats occurring. But the space itself, so steady, not fluctuating. We, in one sense, are safe in space because it isn't fluctuating. But we forget, and so we sit with a bit of tension that may not be. So steady, this inner space. Spacious, accommodating to what arises in it. Ultimately empty, thing that is composed. And now with the outer space, so vast, it doesn't stop in this neighborhood, of course, it goes on throughout Seattle, all the way down and up the coast, the west coast, and across the ocean. So vast, and up into the skies and the heavens and beyond, and down, down, down. So vast, this external space. Staying mindful, staying embodied in space, and knowing that you're embodied in space through body. How still space is. Now, as we stay in this space, as direct experience, the spaciousness of space, there's something that's rather amazing, and that is that this knowing quality can embrace all of this space despite its vastness, the knowing quality, that which knows, consciousness itself, can embrace and contain it all. So with space as our object, we start to notice this infinite consciousness. Vast, vast, vast. What is this awareness? How is it characterized, this consciousness, this vast consciousness? It too is empty, and yet is containing all of these things, the paradox of the emptiness of this knowing capacity and the vast, vast amount that is known, the continuity of knowing, its constant responsiveness to the mind creating moments of consciousness, untiring, undemanding. It's available to whatever degree the body systems can maintain themselves to utilize this consciousness. More subtle than space, able to contain the knowing of space and the way that space can't know consciousness. Vast, steady, empty, alive, responsive. Call it a field of awareness, if that's helpful. Thus, the truth of the Buddha's teachings about things can be known without end. Now, taking this consciousness as our object, spaciousness is in the background, space in the background. If we lose consciousness as our object, we go back to space, either in the body or outside the body or both. But now, consciousness itself is our object. If you get lost, you can go all the way back to the physical body. But if you have choice, stay with this knowing, this awareness, so vast that it can even know. The stillness of space can sometimes start to overwhelm us and lead us to the spaciness. That's really not being with space and not being with knowing. So balance yourself out. Get more concrete when you need to. When you get spacey, start spacing out. Just come back when you realize it. Through the body, if that's helpful. Through the space, if that's helpful. Be very calm, very clear that you wish to be with the knowing. That you're resting attention on the knowing. Invite the mind to brighten. May the mind brighten. And now start to bring your attention more in ordinary levels. But first, regaining space as the primary object and this knowing quality as the second object. So just the opposite attention to the edges of the physical body. And now come down to the feeling the earth element in the body, this earth element in the pelvis, feeling it in the tops or sides of the bottom that are making of the feet that are. And now just be embodied, but just be. You're not directing attention anywhere other than to the stillness of just. Now direct your attention to the belly area in the physical body. That Hara Point or Tanyin, this place is right below, and we just be. Can you feel the stillness? Local and non-local. And through these body sensations or through the breath, awareness present in the ever-changing. That stillness is present in everything that's changing. Let that stillness and let loose of any efforting around it. Nothing needs to be done. And there's no one that has to do it. And yet things do get done. We don't have to be so identified with a participant observer. We are participating, but we're also observing, so we're in this balance of stillness and movement. So we're not so identified with the soap opera. And there's more space, there's this vast space around experience. And this knowing, it's so reliable as a place to, it's not really a place, that's not the right word, but as a way of resting attention, of meeting the moment. So this question about stillness and movement, it comes down in a dharmic sense. As we said yesterday, to the desire and aversion and so forth, the mind moving based on wanting of one form or another, or based on reactivity or one form or another, or the mind just being in deluded form, one state or another. These we call the hindrances. So this is the way Eliot suggests that we hold the opposites, the ultimate opposites. Desire itself is movement. Movement towards, movement away. It's just what desire does. Desire itself is movement, not in itself desirable. We know that dharmically, right? We grasp because of the movement when we're not awake, when we don't have choice, when we don't remember we have choice, when we don't look to see if we have choice. Desire itself is movement, not in itself desirable. Love is itself unmoving, only the cause and end of movement. So this, if we want to call this responsive consciousness love, this vast field of awareness that's empty, but is benign, has this benign quality, this responsiveness that we know in our life is our quality of responsiveness, of benignness, that vibrational, energetic quality of this knowing the moment has this kind of quality to it. If you're comfortable with this way of practice, then we can say that that's love as manifest in the realm, that it's before it's taken any personal form. So Joseph used to, when he would teach emptiness, he would say, and then you get to the very bottom, and this was every fall retreat for 10 years or something, and he would talk about it as being ultimately empty. And then one year he changed, and he says, and at the very essence of that emptiness, there is love. And I was so thrilled because that had been my experience. And I had gone into him repeatedly year after year and said, you know, Joseph, you know, we have so much alike in what we experience, but I actually experience this thing of love. And he would never make any comment about that. And so I couldn't wait for the next interview to go in and say, ah, see. So I walk in and I sit down and I say, you know, in your talk night before last, da 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 da, and then you said, you used to say da, now you said love. He said, I did. And that was his degree of attachment. So there's a story about this monk who picked up a nun who was older and frail and carried her across this river because they had to get across this river because that area was going to flood. So they had to get to safety. So the monk picked up the nun and carried her across the river. And there was this young novice monk who was so upset that this monk had touched not just a woman, but touched a nun. And he was so disappointed because this was his mentor, you know. He just fumed. So mile after mile, as they were walking to where they were going, he was emanating that upsetness with it. And finally, the senior monk said, you know, seems like you're a little upset. Yeah, you touched a woman, and she's a nun. You, he goes, yes, I did, out of compassion. But when I got to the other side, I put her down. You're the one who's still carrying her. So we can be like that in our views and opinions. And maybe I had a little bit of that in that moment. Desire itself is movement, not in itself desirable. Love is itself unmoving, only the cause and end of movement. Love, he's continuing with love now. Love, okay, only the cause and end of movement. Timeless and undesiring. So this is this quality of this vast consciousness, this consciousness that's empty, this awareness, if you prefer. Timeless and undesiring, except in the aspect of time. So this consciousness that itself vast and empty is manifesting in you and you and you and you and you and me and you and you and you and her and him and then in just this very moment. Timeless and undesiring, except in the aspect of time, caught in the form of limitation between unbeing and being. That's the contradiction, you say. To be in time, there is a form. The aggregates, the five aggregates teaching, it is in form. So even that which is empty, if it's going to be known in any way, it's going to take the limitation of form to be in this realm. It's the nature of this realm is one of form. It's its nature. For good and not good. Time past and time future allow but a little consciousness. To be conscious is not to be in time, but only in time can the moment in the rose garden, the moment in the arbor where the rain beat, the moment in the drafty church at Smokefall be remembered, involved with past and future. Only through time is time conquered. So in that eternal journey, that the eternal journey is manifesting and then letting loose of manifesting. The Buddha manifested in order to let loose. He conquered time through time. He was in the form. Took him a long time. The myth of it is many, many lifetimes. That may well be true. You may think that's nonsense, but either way, he was in time. And his claiming is that he moved and outside of time and outside the characteristics of time, including creating karma for himself, further karma for himself. So in little small ways, maybe we can do this too. Maybe our karma is more wholesome karma, that we, the plants, the seeds we plant, that we drop into this moment through mindful intention. Mindful intention. As the things become habit, we don't need mind. So we have all these moments of compassion or these moments of sharing, of generosity. Those become habit, and so we don't have to like use the mindfulness and the intention so much, because they've taken form. You see, they've taken form in this realm in that way, but except under circumstances where we then become not sharing and not kind. But they take more and more of that. But we start with this mindful intention. And the intention is not this roaring kind of attention. It's so quiet. And as I've said in the last group, it can be so far back that we were talking about sleepiness. Like you're too sleepy to be present. But if you have any energy at all to intend towards being present, you're dropping in the ground of being, that intention of presence. And who can say, is that seed more wholesome or more powerful than a seed when you're all bright and energized and all of this? It seems so because you're present. But is that really true? I don't know. It certainly seems to me that sometimes when we're practicing with the mind that's really restless and won't settle down at all, but we still have that intention to be present, that that is really great practice. That I can argue that that's at least as wholesome a practice as when everything's going great and you're seeing it all or you're steady or whatever. I can argue that. I don't claim to know that, but I am certainly not willing to let someone tell me one way or the other either. I don't know. I'm not sure it can be known from this side of the river. Maybe it's only when one crosses the further shore, reaches that island, that one can't go beyond that one knows. So I'm asking you to consider holding this mindful intention and more of an unknown, rather than it's like something that we would ordinarily know. Like, you know, if you're closer, you're getting more on the spot that you're trying to get something on that you're spraying. It's maybe not like that. Maybe this quality is different than that. It's operating on an energetic level, not on the manifest. So this is one way of understanding, resolving the opposites. The other way I was going to read you for a moment, and this is really hard to understand, so don't try to understand it. Hear the opposites in it. In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there's no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you do not own. And where you are is where you are not. Now that's pretty confusing, huh, and obscure. It's very much like a Zen koan. But that is, we move through the contradictions with an ease. We're trusting our mindfulness. We're trusting the wholesomeness of our intention to move into these contradictions, to these opposites of stillness and movement, life and death, gain and loss, pain and pleasure, blame and ill repute, pleasant and unpleasant. We are not afraid to know both sides. We're not afraid. Our comfort is in our practice. So with that, as in terms of the conclusion, I brought this in here before this kind of teaching, because it, because we don't ordinarily do it, and you're such a good group for it. I would like to hear, as we come to the close of our day, about the last walking practices, any experience you've had, and then anything else that you want to bring up. But I particularly would like to hear about your walking experiences, if you're willing to share. But again, anything else you want to bring up. Well said. Well said. Thank you for that. And what you were seeing, in a way, was yet another display of the opposites. Isn't that something? And we miss it. You know, we miss it because we think this is right, or no, that's right. Or da, da, da. Hold them both. Someone else, please. Can you say a little more? Yes. Did you follow him? So he was saying that in the stillness, that he was saying that the more you open the heart, it's like an aperture opening, and you get to see more and more of what, or feel more, experience more of what, of the stillness. That with the open heart actually gives more access to the stillness. Rather than you think it might think it'd go the other way, that you'd be all over objects all the time. But not necessarily when the heart is open. Why? Because what characterizes the heart being open in part is a kind of stillness, because it's not fluctuating so much. Thank you for that. That's a subtle distinction. The reason I'm wanting, I've learned so much from your responses. This is the most I've ever done, and you have reinforced my, I've started doing more and more of this, but this is the most I've done. So, and you've reinforced that, and I really feel like I've learned from it. But now I'm wanting you to hear each other's experience to sort of stimulate you for further exploration. That is my aspiration. Thank you. Right. And this suggests something about retreat practice too. So I often will do my walking inside for the value of the containment. And at IMS, till they changed the kitchen, I used to love to walk between the tables. And there, you know, the chairs are there. It's something about all that containment really kept me present, you know. Nature's beautiful.
I know.
And once again, there's the opposites. Yeah. And how to be at ease and flow with the opposites, you know, dance with life. It's beautiful. So thank you for that. One of the insights that can come up around that is in relation to sense consciousness, that vijnana, the five aggregate sense consciousness, because the regular consciousness is being referred to as in relation to all the senses, including the mind. And so this, the Buddha's teaching about the eye is burning and the ear is burning. Do you know that sutta? That's seeing that. That's the kind of thing you see coming out of the stillness, that as soon as you start going to sense consciousness, you can see how it tends to bring a grasping to it. And the Buddha says, what is it burning? And it's burning with the oil of grasping, of wanting, and so forth. And you get to see that in the movement. And it doesn't mean that life is terrible. No, life is, love manifests this realm and all. But so people get out of this, they think Buddhism's negative in nature. And the Buddha was so clear that he was not a nihilist in any way. But you do see the predicament. You see the opposites at play. So, yeah, you can, that was seeing, you were having, that's a moment of insight, what you were seeing about disenchantment, yes. So disenchantment leading to dispassion, leading to freedom. So the dispassion is that the dispassion is, it's my form of saying this. It has its attractive side to it, but there's not a wanting. So it arises as being known in its characteristics, but then you don't buy in. There's no wanting. So it can be there or not be there, but you're not caught into wanting. And so, yeah, so that's real insight around that, that will come. And what we discover the other way, when there's stillness, the mind is so content that it is not, once it really finds that stillness, it takes some effort or some period of time for the mind to move away from its stillness. It's just so content. It's not tuned out. It's not spaced out. That's why I was in the meditation doing the difference between spacey and spacious. That spacious stillness is not tuned out at all. It's not spacey. You're really present. But the mind gets so satisfied. I feel it as a physical sensation when it becomes like that. I will often, before I realize that I'm getting concentrated, there's this kind of thing. I feel it as an energetic or physical or some kind of change, like in the brain. The brain chemistry changes in some way for me. Other people don't have any of that experience necessarily, but it so happens I do. Maybe because I've had so many blows to my head my entire life that it's made me sensitive that way. I don't know, but yeah, that's really interesting, because you found a way to observe the formations happening just in that Yeah. But what you would do is you just go to the experience. You don't have to have all of this larger picture of it. You could just go to that stillness and do the inquiry you just did. Yeah, no, that's quite true. And I think most of us have experiences like that. What can be discovered as walking between those chairs is that when the mind gets concentrated, it is contented. It doesn't so much matter what the mind's concentrated on, that it's collected and unified and not grasping after something is the contentment, not what it's concentrated on. So any other comments or questions before we... Deepa Ma, in our tradition, Deepa Ma did that. If you've sat 3 hours straight or something like that, if you've sat somewhere beyond what you imagined, and you're just like, there's no reason to move, all of that just gets extended as far as I can. I've never sat 3 days, so I can't really answer the question for you. But it just goes on. I could not imagine sitting for 3 hours because my body would so kill me. And after, you know, but it just, at some point, all that just falls away. And when he talked about it, he talked about preparing himself in terms of not taking food ahead of time because of no need for, you know, bowels and biological breaks or something like that, and like preparing himself. And since these are ordinary people like me and you who are having these experiences, we have to receive that as, okay, our definition of these things are more immediate and not necessarily what's really true under the right conditions. Balancing meditation, movement, and did you add a third? Reading, study, yes. So all three are wholesome. And I recommend having a daily practice that is sustainable. So you do it less length. I'd rather you did 20 minutes every day or most days rather than do an hour once or twice a week, because that hour once or twice a week will tend to fall away altogether, whereas a more of a daily practice tends to be to sustain itself. And as I said in the small groups, starting with a little bit of walking can actually encourage your getting there for some people and not for others, but for some people. And to sit at a time of day that makes sense for you, even if it means that you get up 15, 20 minutes earlier than you ordinarily do. So you can't say, I don't have time. You're just giving up some sleep for that. or in the evening when you have kind of downtime or wasted time or in between time that you're not necessarily utilizing well anyway. And one way to clear out that evening time, if you're kind of wasted and you don't have much energy, is to do walking meditation and then do sitting practice, or just do walking meditation alone. I really like listening to talks myself, and then reading judiciously, and reading for something that's stirring me as a whole, not just getting me thinking. That's something that leads to practice as opposed to something that leads to more thinking. That's the distinction I make. What inspires me to practice? Other people have very different views. And then having a Dharma buddy, somebody that you sit with, finding a Sangha, coming to a group and letting, not all of us, but most of us are really sustained by the group. There's times we ride the group's energy when we don't have the energy. I like doing half-day practices or whole-day practices that are what I call self-retreats, where I'm by myself, or sometimes I'll have a friend and we share making the meal. One person makes one meal, one another, for half a day or a day or the whole weekend, something like that. And that really helps. Going off on retreat, which inspires a home or practice if you can afford the time. Well, I want to acknowledge the volunteers who've done the various work, who've taken care of things here. Thank you for that. And your support of Sangha, the people who've washed those cups, all the many different ones, the people who put out the tables, all the many different ways that you are receiving, that I am receiving the kindness of others, that someone made me lunch, that just all the little moments of kindness that happen in retreat, that which we can kind of tend to forget or not acknowledge to ourselves, that we are the recipients of generosity. And the more we feel that, the more inclined we are to take our turn doing this. And it really feels good to be a volunteer. When I was an Aikidoist, the tradition was you cleaned the mat afterwards because, the mat gets dirty from sweaty bodies and it needs cleaning. And I was always so interested how there was maybe a third of the people or 25% of the people were inclined to clean the mat. And I was always happy to clean the mat because I liked that feeling. It was like I'm getting to honor something that I've received. And I feel that way about the Dharma, that when we sit, that it's a pleasure. And I love on retreats having yogi job. I like having a yogi job. I like that we're self-sustaining as a community and that I'm doing my part and all. And I just mention this because SIMS and every organization, all of the Buddhist organizations depend on volunteer work, but not as an obligation, not like, oh, I gotta pay back. But no, I want to. And the feeling when you're doing it, setting up a room, and all these people are going to sit in the room, it's a good feeling. For my first years of having a group, I went by myself and set up the whole room, and then people would come in. And then without my ever saying a word, I would get there, and here's this person waiting on me. And now we're setting up the room. And then a few weeks later, here's another person. And the time came when I no longer set up the room, But no one was ever asked to set up the room. And just lovely in that way, just lovely. So that too is Dharma practice. And then the other thing I want to say about our time together, I have used walking practice in this way. I didn't do this time how to walk your question. I didn't do that because that's not what we were doing, but I've done that other times, other retreats, and people here would know how to do that. This has evolved from my own practice. And so you can't go up to some other teacher and say, well, what walking practice explorations do you teach? They'd go, what? What are you talking about? So I would ask that you respect that and not make it a burden to someone else and not get me in trouble. because my orientation, as most teachers, I think, is to teach from my own experience, my own practice, what's brought insight and freedom to me. So that this is coming out of that. You're practicing inside my practice for good and ill. And the ill part, I'm pointing to things that you're not necessarily supposed to completely understand yet. I'm planting seeds. I'm encouraging you to shake you out of your established perceptions, and that can sometimes be disruptive in some way or another. And if so, I apologize for that, and I take responsibility for it, and ask your forgiveness in that if anything like that has happened. I am too old not to teach more of what it is I know to teach. I'm just too old to spoon feed in that way. It just doesn't make any sense. There's no harmony in that. So more and more I am starting to really teach my experience. And so that can be at times going to be, well, that doesn't match me at all, or I don't know what he's talking about, or various things can happen. And I'm knowingly doing this because it feels harmonious in relation to the time I won't be around to share my experience. So I'm owning that publicly like this so that everybody knows. And you can say, oh, don't go to his thing because he talks about all these things that are too subtle. That'll be okay. So, but I do, I'm totally sincere about the, and with that, I think we can just close. And again, I would close with the loving kindness that we did yesterday. That was so beautiful. And again, I would encourage you to receive the loving kindness when it comes into the room through one of those phrases. And in that silence between the phrases. So this is call and response out loud. For any harm. Sorry, I was going in the wrong thing. I was doing because I've just done the forgiveness thing. I started to do that. You all are not in a position where you need to do that. Never mind. May you be safe from internal and external harm. May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart. May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital. May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life, just as it is merit now, as we learn to reconcile the opposites, to be able to live in both, in between both, around the both, undefined by them. May it bring wisdom and compassion to ourselves and to our loved ones and to everyone with whom we come in contact. Any merit that has come from our giving our time to deepening our understanding, we offer that merit to the well-being of all beings without preference, without demand or exchange, without discrimination. May all beings in ways small and large benefit from our practice, directly or indirectly. May all beings find their way out of the suffering of this realm in a way that brings a sense of harmony.